such a refreshing testimony from our choir this morning about going home. We live in a society that is death-denying, a society that does not want us to spend too much time dwelling on negative things, so it would seem, on our own demise. I believe that as pastor, my job is not only to figure out how to preach a good sermon when people die, but to help us as a congregation prepare, as it were, for the significance and the import of what our lives mean and the truth that they will one day come to an end. This past week at our Wednesday evening faith formation series that we've been having and very, very powerfully presented by our guest presenters, we welcomed Major Reverend Sean Yaskew, a United Church minister who now works full-time in the Canadian Forces in the office of the chaplain. And he was sharing about his own journey, particularly though the past year has been quite a tumultuous one for them as a family and for him. When he took this job, he was told that there would be a very, 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 very small chance that he would be deployed since it was an office job. Well, sure enough, that very, 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 very small chance came to be. And he was deployed. Went through turmoil within himself, but also his family, when he broke the news to his wife, to his mother, that he would have to go into harm's way to Afghanistan, to Kandahar. And one of the things he shared with us was in his job, part of his task is to help prepare soldiers to reflect on why they're undertaking the mission, why they are entering into this, and what may be some of the stumbling blocks or some of the concerns, whether in their family or in themselves, that may pose a threat or pose a problem or a concern for their ability to discharge their duties. Both in that preparation and when he was on the field, in the field, talking with soldiers, he discovered that there were tremendous questions that were being asked, questions of faith. And he said that in his experience, both pre, during, and post-war, that the Canadian Forces personnel with whom he'd had the chance to speak went through great cathartic and tumultuous experiences with their view and picture of God. For some of them, it destroyed the notion that they had of God before going, and they were able to come up with a deeper, more engaged relationship with God. For others, that destruction persisted. No longer could they trust this God that they had been taught about when they were young or they had come to know. And at the last time of conversing with some of them, they still persisted in those questions, those doubts, that rage. We do not have to go through the experience of war to know that in our own lives, we too are pushed as people of faith to wrestle with what does it mean to engage this God, to be engaged by God, and to understand what God's purposes are for us and where God fits into the life that we live. If you have questions like, why is there so much suffering in my life? Other people don't seem to have it as hard as me. Why, God, are you punishing me? What have I done to deserve this? I've been good. Why on earth is this going on in my life? I can't understand you, God. God, you don't even seem like you're here. Are you there, God? If you had similar questions, then the book of Job is for you and for me. Why are you here today? Why have you come? Have you come out of a sense of duty? Have you come because you think it might be good for business? You come to see your friends? Have you come to hide from God? Think about that question myself. Reminds me of the story of a son whose mother went in to wake him up on a Sunday morning. Wake him up for church. Oh, Mom, I don't want to go. Come on, son, it's time to get up. You know, we always go to church. I want to sleep in like everybody else gets to on Sunday morning. How many people are going to church these days anyway? Plus, the people there, they probably don't even want to see me. They probably don't even care whether I come or not. I don't want to go, Mom. Son, let's go to church. It's time to get up. Give me one reason why I should go. Mother said, I'll give you two. One is that you're 42 years old and you're the minister of the church. It may be that I have to be here. But why are we here? It was Mark Twain that said, more people go to church than want to. Are you hoping for a word from God that intersects somehow with life as you live it now? I want to promise you that I trust the commitment of God, communicated through Jesus Christ and through those down through the ages who have rehearsed and rededicated himself to that commitment, that when we gather in worship together as a community of faith, God shows up. I promise you that. By faith. God shows up, perhaps not in the way we would want God to, or speaks to us, or communicates and draws near, but God shows up for our good. And ours is the privilege and task of discerning such a showing. That's what Job was crying for, that God would show up. I want to remind you just briefly about the context of Job. There may be some here not familiar with this story in our Hebrew scriptures, in our Old Testament. It is a genius of a literary work, I believe. And we have been wrestling with this, around 20 of us here at Parkville and some from other churches, every Tuesday morning at Bible study with the book of Job, wrestling with this. The story begins with Job, who is, by all accounts, and even by the testimony of God, is a blameless, an upright person, someone who fears God, someone who indeed does what is right. There's this little exercise that takes place in the heavenly courts, as it were. And this is not a book that is meant to be taken literally, but literarily in the sense that it exposes a particular point of view and a way of understanding the questions that are posed in the book. And there's this scene that takes place at the beginning with God and the heavenly council. And there's present what's called the Satan with a definite article. It is a position. It is a particular post, as it were, kind of like the attorney general, who engages in a conversation with God and says that people, the only reason people show up to worship at Parkdale United Church, or the only reason why people follow you, is what they can get out of it. And God says, no, have you considered my servant Job? He is blameless, upright. And the drama unfolds. God allows the Satan, this attorney, heavenly attorney general, as it were, to destroy Job's life without taking his actual physical life. All the things that were important to him, his family and his reputation and his wealth and servants and all of those things, to take those things away, to see if Job would curse God, to see if God, Job would turn his back. And this happens and Job does not. Sores on his body, anguish at the devastation of his life. Everything that he held dear, except for God and perhaps his very life, gone. And the book of Job is the story of how Job wrestles with the questions that come up for those people of faith who want to make sense of deep tragedy, not only in their lives, but in life, as it were. Job as a book is intended to take on, head on, the tradition within Israel, but also other nations of the day, what's called the wisdom tradition. It's a wisdom tradition that we are not that unfamiliar with because it persists even to this day. It goes like this. Be righteous and do good, God will reward you. Do evil and bad things, God will punish you. That was the simple calculus of behavior and have the things worked. What happened, however, when people then and now observe that that doesn't seem to work. People who seem to live lives of upright and blameless commitment to the ways of good and the noble gifts of God experience deep suffering. And people whom we would judge to be absolutely unrighteous and evil seem to get away with everything. They noticed it, we noticed it, and so the battle begins. How do we make sense of that? The wisdom tradition within Israel was a tradition that is what's called contestable. It was not the thus saith the Lord angle of things. It was rather an observation of life and an attempt to make sense of it. Walter Brueggemann calls it the right reading of life and things as they are. That, in and of itself, is a debatable thing. How are we to make sense of this? So the question for each of us in our own lives that we raise up are gathered up in an embrace of permission giving in the book of Job. Job is audacious. Job is absolutely almost at the limit, if you will, of being blasphemous. Job pushes the limit of his relationship with God. He asks questions about why has this happened? And he decides that God himself has turned against him. That God has created this relationship of enmity. God has done this to him and he wants to know why. Because he insists he is innocent. Listen to what Job says in a few verses before our text today. Accusing God. He has walled up my way so I cannot pass and has set darkness upon my path. He has stripped me from my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. My hope he has pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath, his anger against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together and they have cast a siege around me and encamped around my little tent. The guests in my house have forgotten me. My maidservants have counted me a stranger. I call out, they do not answer. I am repulsive even to my wife. Even young children on the street despise me. I rise up and they talk against me. Job rages, and we can add our own complaints. We are estranged from our children, and we don't know why. We cannot pay the mortgage anymore. The long-enduring sickness. Alzheimer's has come and I can't bear caring anymore, although I have promised to care for my loved one. Why is this happening to me? I don't deserve this. We can add our own story. Job gives us permission to bring before God the questions and the anguish that absolutely assails our soul. And when we hear this particular text, it seems as if Job has quickly gone to that place of utter trust and everything is going to be okay. And we can't help but thinking that when we hear this text, because Handel's Messiah has done a wonderful job. That phrase, do you know the phrase I'm referring to? I know that my Redeemer liveth. Have you heard that? It is a wonderful testimony. But sometimes beautiful and even elegant interpretations of things that are written take us away from the original meaning. It may be that we end up there at one point in our lives and in our confession of faith. But here, Job is not there yet, and he gives us permission to stay with the anguish and to stay with the questions that almost seem rude to put before God. That is one of the things I love about the Hebrew tradition, both of the prophets and of the lamenters and of the wisdom literature. For we find even in our scriptures today, a battle is ongoing. Do you remember the Psalm 145 that we read together? Did anyone stumble over or feel or even raise perhaps to yourselves a question about that which was the settled view of the wisdom tradition within Judaism? The Lord watches over all who love Him, but all the wicked He will destroy. That's the way it went. That's what Job at one point even perhaps believed as well. But somehow now his foundations of faith and trust in that wisdom calculus has been shaken. He's not so sure anymore. And our faith, if our faith is indeed to grow and to be stretched as it ought, it has to be remembered, as it were, which assumes that first it is dismembered. We cannot sustain the deep questions of life and the things that happen to us with a Sunday school version of faith. The very fact that each of you are here and can more or less sit up where you are means that your muscles are working. The way in which muscle grows and muscle is able to do its work is through micro tears in it. Muscle is formed by scar tissue that results from tearing. There needs to be a stretching in order for our faith to grow in maturity. There comes a time when we say, I'm not sure I believe that anymore. My life experience, what I see in the world, poses questions that I cannot answer with my neat formula. Do good, God will reward you. Do bad, you get punished. It doesn't work that way. And what we learn from Job is an invitation to be audacious in our questioning so that our faith will be directed to God always, even what looks like bombastic questions and queries. Let it come. Let it flow. Let the honesty of your heart, let the reality of your life give utterance to the things you need to say. One of the things that we learn from Job is that he refuses, even tenaciously, as he on one hand, out one side of his mouth, is bombastic and absolutely questioning of God. He refuses to let go of that relationship. It is the thing he most wants. And this is what this particular text says. Another phrase that we get in our common language that doesn't suit what the original meaning is that phrase that we have in verse 20. You know the expression. I escaped with the skin of my... Did you know this is where it comes from? Right here in Job, in our text today. Verse 20, my bones cleave to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Actually, the Hebrew is more accurately represented with the skin of my teeth. And what Job is referring to is not that he narrowly escaped something that was absolutely threatening to him. But what he is saying is actually a metaphor for absolute devastation. All that I have escaped, this torment that God has brought on me with, is the skin on my teeth. It's a metaphor and it's hyperbole. Do we have skin on our teeth? No. What Job is saying is that I am left with nothing. Nothing. But Job is so convinced about his innocence, so convinced about it, that he proclaims, death is going to come before I am vindicated. I am sure of this. Earlier on, he wanted to take God to court, to put God on trial. But he even surmises that that is not possible anymore. For God has stacked the deck against him. But he persists and he commits to this enduring recognition that he is innocent. And we know that because God agrees with him. But God has been silent here. Job's doing all the talking, all the spewing. And Job says, what he asks for is for some mercy. And he's asking that when he's dead and gone, that somewhere there will be recorded on a stone his protests of his innocence. That there will be some way of bearing testimony that he was unjustly dealt with in life. That's what he wants. And then he says, somewhere, somehow, there's going to be somebody who is going to vindicate me. When he says, I know that my vindicator, my Goel, Redeemer, shouldn't be capitalized there. I know that my Goel lives. That somebody who's going to stand up for me. And in the court of appeal, in his mind, it may not at this point be God he has in mind. But somebody, maybe somebody in the heavenly court. Someone is going to speak for me. Somebody's going to let the world know, let all know that I am innocent. Because he feels death will come before that day. But notice this. Throughout all of it, Job most wants, most desires, and has a remembered faith that he will see God. That God will show up. In Latin, the word that we use, member, membre, means flesh. It means Job is trying to re-enflesh his relationship with God. Any of us here who are tenuously holding on because of the deep and dark suffering of your soul, holding on to any sanity, holding on to any faith at all, be encouraged and assured that God and those whom God appoints to come around you will help you to remember, to reattach, to re-enflesh that faith. And it will be a different faith than the one you used to have. It's going to be stretched and prodded, not as firm perhaps, but differently engaged in a trusting relationship with God. By the end of Job, and we haven't gotten there yet in our text here or our Bible study, but it is an important framework. By chapter 39, 30, and 40 and beyond, God shows up and speaks to Job. Puts Job in his place. Have you laid the foundations of the world? Can you make a hippopotamus, Job? Well, of course not. Job, listen to me. I'm going to come to you as you need, not as you have been asking. I'm coming in spite of your questions, not necessarily because of them, because this is who I am. I'm a God that wants authentic, honest relationship with you. I don't want you to go through the motions. I don't want you to just believe and show up at this place or anywhere just because you think it's expected of you or because you think you're going to get something from me by doing that. What I want is for you, God says, to be honest and truthful. I want you to wrestle with the questions, to ask those deep and hard things that have to be asked about why you are on earth, why your life matters, and why I so desperately want a relationship with you. How that is going to change things, that's what I want. So when I show up in your life, God says, welcome the fact that you will not get me as you hoped. God does not want us to try to figure out the system and work the system of God. It's blasphemous. God wants us to relish and languish the mystery of God's commitment to us. Trust that it is loving, benevolent, gracious, forgiving and healing. Trust that it is embracing and merciful. That's all. Trust God. The details of that, you and I are invited to wrestle with together. Not to manipulate God. Not to appear holier than thou over others. Not to feel we have some secret knowledge that we can hold over others. but that we can respond with the kind of gratitude that enables us to risk being not only honest with ourselves and in our relationships, but also brave and courageous to do the things that God calls us to. Why? Because we trust that relationship that is unbreakable. Not because we deserve it or we are good, but because it is the nature, the character, and the commitment of God to covenant with us through Jesus Christ. We are each profoundly complex people. There are over 100 trillion neurons in our brains. At any given time, there are 400 million functions of our brain taking place, only about 2,000 of which we are aware. Some of you might remember that television show, Star Trek. One of the key features of the Star Trek series is a mechanism they have called a transporter. The transporter beams you from one place to the other. In order to do that, the transporter, in the concept of this science fiction, is able to read, remember, and to reproduce every single detail and data element of your being. Convert it to a pure beam of light and transport it to somewhere else and reconstitute you. Scientists tell us it is impossible. Sorry for those of you who are waiting for it to come about. There is no computer conceived now or even in the future that can account for all the permutations and combinations of the complexity of who you and I are. Cannot. Only God can do that, because God has created us. It is this God who has lovely, wonderfully, and preciously made each and every one of us. Desperately, earnestly desires a relationship, personal and intimate, with every one of us. Figuring out and relishing and growing and cultivating that relationship is our chief aim in life. Because in so doing, we will find our way. We will discover our purpose. And we will be joined eternally to the one who discloses, grants, summons, and sends. But like all true and passionate and loving relationships, it has to be built on honesty and love. May you and I be gifted with a remembered faith, a faith that is reattached in the way that God configures, so that we would be strong, patient, humble, and gracious enough to engage this world that God has made and so loves. Amen.